When Roger Maxwell was growing up in Marshalltown, segregation was very real.
We just accepted the conditions here. We knew where we could not go, and so you just accepted that.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Even though he accepted his situation, that didn't stop Roger Maxwell from wanting to change things. He became the first member of his family to go to college. He became an accomplished musician and teacher and an advocate for civil rights. He worked for the Iowa Civil Rights Commission and the Board of Regents for many years. And he was recently inducted into the University of Northern Iowa School of Music Jazz Hall of Fame. I'll talk with him. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This spring, Roger Maxwell was inducted into the University of Northern Iowa School of Music Jazz Hall of Fame. It's an honor that recognizes his lifetime of contributions as a musician, but his good work and influence extends well beyond the world of music. He was one of the founding members of the jazz program at UNI, a music teacher, conductor, and chief arranger for the U.S. Army Band of the Pacific for a time, and author of 14 Weeks to a Better Band and other instructional books that have sold collectively more than 700,000 copies, but he dedicated the bulk of his career to fighting for civil rights. He became a member of the staff for the Iowa Civil Rights Commission in 1966. Later on, he was their director of compliance, and he served as equal employment compliance officer with the Iowa State Board of Regents for 26 years. Today, he is here with me to talk about his life, his work, and his love of music. Roger Maxwell, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
I want to go back in time to your childhood. You grew up in Marshalltown, Iowa, and your dad had come to Iowa from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Your mom was born in the state?
Yes, right there in Marshalltown.
Nice. And even though Iowa was a pretty progressive state, segregation was very real here. Did your family talk about that as you were growing up?
Well, yes. I knew segregation at 5 years old. I had two brothers and three sisters who were older than I. And in the household, we talked, you know, segregation many, many times, almost on a daily basis as to what residents and areas which we could not live in. We talked about restaurants and hotels. We talked about employment possibilities, you know, who would deny people. So I grew up with it, starting 5 years old.
And your family was really impacted by this in so many ways, but one of the unique ways that you were impacted was, of course, at that time in Marshalltown, when African Americans came to town, there were no hotels who were willing to put them up. And your house became a place where people would come and stay. Why was that? How did your house become that house?
Well, my mother was a very immaculate housekeeper, and people, she worked for some of the finest families there. I shouldn't say finest, but families there in Marshalltown who were kind of prevalent, known in the community. And so she worked for a domestic for many of those companies, families. And she knew, you know, that word went out that Margaret Maxwell is an immaculate housekeeper. So that's how our reputation and my mother's being the immaculate housekeeper, that's how it went forth throughout the community.
That's so hard to imagine because she worked for other families, so she spent her days cleaning for other people, and she had six kids. I can't even begin to tell you what my house would look like in that case.
Well, you know, we all had responsibilities there, and we did everything in our power to help our mother and father. Just got through some difficult times. We did not realize what being, as we had described, poor today. But my father, when he came off of work working at the drugstore, he and my older brother would go down to the railroad and take what we call burlap bags and pick up coal because we just could not afford to buy coal from the local companies there. So we would take that coal, put it in the basement, and that's how we kept ourselves warm because we just didn't have the funds. I remember one time that we accumulated $7, and there was a company there which was not too far from where we lived. And I opened the door there of the basement, and you cannot believe the excitement to see coal come in from this company into our basement. And it was $7 for that ton of coal. It was just – so all of us had jobs, and so during our whole lifetime, we always were assisting our mother and father.
So taking in visitors to Marshalltown was another way to contribute to the household budget. I know that the Wolf Eye Clinic was nearby, and so you would take in black patients who were going to be at the clinic, but you also took in a lot of really high-profile visitors over the years. Jesse Owens stayed at your home. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was 16 years old, and so we had a call, my mother did, and said, you know, we have a Jesse Owens coming, and would you be able to accommodate him, you know, in a sleeping arrangement? My mother said, absolutely. So Jesse and his road manager, they came and stayed with us here for 2 days. And so you just can't imagine how small our upstairs was. There was only 3 bedrooms. So only my brother and I were still there because the other member of families had gone to employment elsewhere out of the city. So my mother and father moved in our what we call the girls' bedrooms. And then my brother and I, we slept together in the front bedroom. And Jesse, the manager, had took my mother and dad's bedroom.
So they had to share.
Yeah, I mean, Jesse Owens probably never in his life shared a bed with his road manager.
Well, sadly, at that time in the United States, he probably had to before. And what a tremendous opportunity, what a special opportunity for your family, but at the same time so shameful that there wasn't another option. Did you talk about that?
Well, the only time we talked about it, I didn't ask him. But this was a given. You know, when you grew up with discrimination in employment and where you could have accommodations to dine, and you knew you just couldn't go there. Golf courses were off limit. The swimming pool was off limit. There was just no place to go. But anyway, I mean, people came, and my mother and dad, we accommodated them.
Did you get an opportunity to really interact and get to know some of the people who stayed in your home?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Jesse, I asked him the question. I was old enough, and I asked the question about his running in 1936 in the Berlin
Olympic Games. Right?
Right. And so anyway, I said, what about the Hitler incident? And he said he heard later that Hitler had left the stadium shortly after one of Jesse's races. And he went on to say that Hitler was a very prompt individual. So Jesse said he thought that the incident was overblown here as far as Hitler not shaking hands with him because he said Hitler just left it. So I thought that was a very – that's never been, you know, publicly spoken about. But that's what he told me, you know, at 16 years old. Another interesting family, my sister reminded me, she's in Los Angeles, and she said, Earl Father Hines. Now, Earl, they call him Earl Father Hines, F-A-T-H-A. He stayed with us in the late 30s, about 1937-38. And here's what's very interesting.
And Earl Hines was a jazz pianist.
Very well known throughout the United States as a jazz pianist. And I think it's very funny here that on a TV show, Two and a Half Men, here if you go up the stairway in that apartment or their home here on the wall, here's a poster of Earl Father Hines, you know. And I look at that when I see Charlie Sheen going up the stairs, and I think, gee, Earl
stayed in our
home. Stayed in our home.
Who were some of the other people that stayed with you over the years?
There was a gentleman named Lawrence Jones. He he organized a home for young people in Piney Woods in Mississippi. And he stayed with us. I mean, he was a president of that, a graduate of University of Iowa. But he stayed with us when he came there, usually on fundraising throughout the through Iowa here. But he's another one that stayed with us. Then the director of the Wings Over Jordan Choir, the most famous black choir, I think, ever.
And that was, they were from Ohio, and that was a very significant moment in your life because you became very interested in the music that the pianist was playing. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, at the concert at the Methodist Church that evening, they gave a performance. Well, again, he and his wife, the director, I don't remember their name, but they stayed with us also. But at that concert, I heard the pianist do something that I'd never heard done on a piano. And so I asked the director, I said, what happened? Would you show me the chords there? So he went to our piano in our home because we had what we called the music room. And so he showed me, and I went across the street to our church. And I sat there for about 6 hours because this chord of progression, he showed me, I sat there so I would never forget it. And it was something like the order of a Dave Brubeck chordal structure. And it just really, it moved me so greatly that I have to tell you this, that I always wanted to write an arrangement for Amazing Grace to the tune of Danny Boy or London Derriere. And so that chordal structure, which I learned from the director of the Wings Over Jordan, I put into an arrangement for four trombones. And it's one of my most favorite pieces of music that we start out with Danny Boy, and then we modulate into the traditional melody of Amazing Grace.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Roger Maxwell, who just this spring was inducted into the University of Northern Iowa School of Music Jazz Hall of Fame. He is a musician, and he also has dedicated his career to fighting for civil rights. We will talk more in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest is Roger Maxwell. He has done so much work over the years as a musician, also as an advocate for civil rights. He was one of the founding members of the jazz program at UNI, and he was inducted into the University of Northern Iowa School of Music Jazz Hall of Fame just this spring. He's also the author of 14 Weeks to a Better Band and other books that collectively have sold more than 700,000 copies. But he spent most of his career fighting for civil rights. He became a member of the staff for the Iowa Civil Rights Commission in 1966. He spent 26 years serving as Equal Employment Compliance Officer with the Iowa State Board of Regents. And before we really dig into your musical career, Roger, I want to bring up something that you mentioned a few minutes ago. You mentioned the swimming pool in Marshalltown. Of course, you grew up in Marshalltown, and how you and your family and other members of the black community in Marshalltown, you weren't allowed to use the pool. And that was something you were involved in standing up and asking for your rights. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, I was attending the playground. They had four or five playgrounds throughout Marshalltown in the summer. So I went to our playground closest to our home. And so they the director made an appointment for us, all the young people at the playground, most of them were Caucasian, to go swimming. So I knew, I already knew that we couldn't go. So anyway, but I said, well, as a member of the playground group, maybe they'd make an exception. So I went with the playground group. Well, the manager of the pool was the high school, I mean the junior high school principal. He was the manager of the pool. And he said, Roger, you know we don't allow Negroes to go swimming. I said, well, I understand. So I left. Well, then anyway, we had a number of Jamaicans, about 50, came to work at the Marshall Canning Company. Almost every night they would come to my parents, our residence there on Boone Street, just to have some place to go. And so we did not, you know, naturally too many of them. We'd serve maybe iced tea or something, but they're almost there every night. And so since I couldn't go, I thought, well, let me take this group over and see, maybe they would be admitted. So here I'm leading this contingent of Jamaican.
And how old were you at this point, Roger?
Oh, I had to be about 10 or 11.
Okay.
So I took the Jamaicans over, and the same manager said, Roger, you know you cannot, we do not allow Negroes to swim. Well, there was a spokesman, his name was Campbell, and he went up to the counter and said, sir, he says, we're not Negroes, we're subjects of the king. And so anyway, that made an impression upon the manager. So he called the city council, and they told him the situation. So they asked the local NAACP president, Wilmer Johnson, whether if the city had opened up another pool. It was just terrible, the condition of the pool. So the, Wilmer Johnson said, no, we will not accept that. So anyway, the city council made a decision that the local Negroes and Jamaicans could swim on Sunday morning from 9 to 11.
Yeah, 2 hours a week. What was the black community like in Marshalltown back then?
Well, I mean, we had certain pockets where we lived. Where I lived on Boone Street, mostly Italian, persons of Italian ancestry and blacks. So we just accepted, you know, the conditions here. We knew where we could not go, and so you just accepted that.
And now you started with the Civil Rights Commission in 1966, and of course we were just talking about growing up in Marshalltown in the 1950s, which demonstrates that not that much progress was made between that time, I guess the 1940s in Marshalltown.
Oh, yeah. Really.
And I want to, before we dig into your work with the Civil Rights Commission too deeply, let's talk about your time at the University of Northern Iowa, because you went to UNI in 1950. You were the youngest of six kids. Had your older brothers and sisters, had they gone to college before you?
No, absolutely not.
So you were the
no.
first one in your family.
Yeah, the first one, and probably the history of the whole Maxwell family. It was just a situation where nobody talked about higher education. Number one, you couldn't afford it, and we had no idea what higher education was.
So what made you want to go to UNI? Where did the idea come from?
Well, my high school band director, his name is Jim Gordon, who has passed away. I love Jim Gordon. But he taught my parents. He worked with me in high school. I played trombone. It was very loud. I think that's the reason I got in the band. But anyway, he taught my parents, and he thought he was had attended UNI. At the time, Iowa State Teachers College. So that's how I went to Iowa State Teachers College.
And in 1950, when you went to UNI, give me an idea. How unusual was it for a black man to go to school at the University of Northern Iowa?
It was, except for one professor, it was a wonderful experience. But we had one professor that I wrote a paper. I put a lot of time in the paper called The Emancipation Proclamation of Abraham Lincoln, freeing the slaves. And the paper was returned to me, and I could not believe it. All in red, it says, I've never heard of this. And here was an F minus on the paper. And so I really wanted to be a social worker, but I later applied to University of Iowa social work. But they said, you know, your grade point level was too low. And it was that F.
Oh.
So wow. Anyway, but the jazz musician program, I learned to write there. I was just astounded to see people sitting next to me who could write music. I never thought, you could write music. How do you do it? Well, anyway, I started writing arrangements. And at one time, I had contributed more arrangements for the jazz program over a probably period of 7 years, even though I graduated, than anyone else. But I must say that we had one incident in about 1953 that we had finished a concert, and one of the persons said, had made arrangements to go to a local night eatery to celebrate. And I knew again that I couldn't go, but I said, I'm going to wait until everybody gets there. So I waited. There were about 25 musicians and girlfriends and vocalists. So I waited until I knew they were there, maybe even ordered. So I came in the club, and I saw a sign in the men's room. And so I went and waited there for about 3 minutes. Then I came out, and I went to check my coat. And the lady behind the area said, we do not serve Negroes. So I said, okay. You know, again, I realized that was going to happen. So I went in the room where all my friends were, and I said, I'm going back to campus. And they said, what do you mean? Where have you been? And they badgered me, you know, teasing. And they said, you know, sit down here. Sit down here. And they made other choice words. And I finally said, the club does not serve Negroes. I will see you back at the campus. They said, what do you mean they don't serve Negroes? Come on, you're kidding. I said, no, this is the truth. So I left. And the next year, nobody ever said a word about it, you know. But anyway, I found out that the group, about, as I said, 25 of them, they got up out of their area, went to get their coats. And the manager came and says, where are you folks going? You know, your order's read. And they said, if you cannot serve a Negro friend of ours, you will not serve us. And they all left.
And they didn't tell you that they did that?
No, I don't know. I didn't know anything about it 2 or 3 years later.
Wow. How did you react when you did find out? That's a wonderful act of friendship.
Well, I mean, we're so close here. Some of them had graduated, those students, so we never discussed it.
Wow.
It was just an act of kindness to support me, you know.
When you graduated from UNI, did you immediately start looking for a teaching job, or did you think, you know, maybe I'm going to be a professional musician?
Well, no. What had happened was my student teacher was in Hudson, Iowa, and my supervisor, I said, you know, I'm going to have trouble. She said, well, let's have you write into a firm which places teachers. The firm's in Chicago. I said, well, that'd be a starter. And so anyway, we wrote there. Well, I saw this position open over in Hazleton, Iowa, and so I called, and I told him, you know, I was a Negro, the term we used, and they invited me up to Hazleton, and the full school board was there. Very nice, nice, cordial friends. And they questioned me, and they offered me a contract, and I accepted it, and so while there, you know, where do you eat? Because the same segregation was in Old Wine and Independence, close cities by. So anyway, then having a haircut, I went to the barbershop here, and the gentleman did a superb job of cutting my hair. It was kind of curly-like, and so he did a good job. And so I got a letter later. He said he enjoyed cutting my hair, but he'd had so many complaints from white customers that he says, please don't come back. So
where did you get your hair cut while you
then
lived in Hazleton?
I had to drive 45 miles to Waterloo to a black barber there.
And were you the only black person living in Hazleton at that time?
Oh, absolutely. There was only one other black family I knew named Dick Bunn. He was a manager at City Laundry. I think that was one of the largest laundry in that area. And he was a manager, very well thought of, he and his wife. And then there's a black farmer over in the Fayette area, Frank Dixon. So, you know, there weren't that many people of color.
How did your students respond to you?
Beg pardon?
How did your students respond to you?
Oh, they, you know, we had a joy. I love those kids. And you would not believe today I received a complimentary message from a student from another school I taught in who was in San Jose, California. My student, I love them. And I took a music contest. The school had never been in music contest. Well, they had been, but never had any number one ratings. So my second year there, we went to music contest, and we received 20 Division I ranking one out of 22 entries.
Wow.
And there was a young man there who lived Hazleton, and he was in seventh grade. And when we saw the ranking that his group, the Trumpet Trail, had received a one, he just burst into tears. Just. And so anyway, when the article came out in the paper recently, he just happened to be in Waverly. He called me, and we were crying on the phone because I talked about his reaction to being seventh grader, Division I, and he lives now in Arizona. But we wept because the joy, I saw that he had the joy of music, and it really inspired me to be go forth as a teacher.
You did spend time in Hawaii. You were the trombonist and the chief arranger for the U.S. Army Band of the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you come back to Iowa after that? I mean, you had seen the big wide world, and I'm sure you had seen places where there were more progressive than Iowa. Why come back?
Well, it's home, and I loved Iowa, and I love teaching. So I thought, well, let me try, get a position here. And it was very interesting. I was in San Francisco, came back on a troop ship, and I call home. My mother says, "You have a call from Waverly, Iowa, regarding a teaching position." And so anyway, I took a streamlined train two and a half days to get back to Iowa, and my mother, she handed me the note. It was not Waverly, it was Wayland, down in southeast Iowa.
So right. Waverly's not a big town, but
no,
it's bigger
sure
than Wayland,
about,
right?
About 700. I got to just say, I love those. I've loved every place I taught. I love the kids. I love their parents. I love the churches.
Roger, in preparation for this interview, I asked you what music we should play, and you suggested playing a Wartburg choir performance. You wanted to play that arrangement of Precious Lord, and we'll play it here in just a moment, but I guess I was a little bit surprised because I was thinking about you and your life and your work in jazz music. And what is it about that performance that moves you so much?
Well, years ago, I read about the composer of Precious Lord, a black gentleman, and he had married he just married this young, beautiful young lady in Chicago. Well, it's my understanding that he was giving a concert in Cleveland, and while he was gone, his wife died. And so he returned, and he wrote the music of Precious Lord, "Take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn." And that's how that all came about. He wrote Precious Lord. Well, then a former board member, Harry Slife, and his wife, Polly, were traveling over the Dubuque area, and they were in a car accident, and they were killed. And so anyway, they had the funeral there in Cedar Falls at the Nazarene Church, I believe it was. And my supervisor and I flew up for the service, and were met by John Connor, who was the vice president of finance at the time at UNI. And so anyway, I didn't realize, who's going to sing. Well, anyway, the Wartburg Choir sang that composition in the balcony. And when they sang part of it at the end, and if you ever play, you got to turn it down the end because the power, and it's loud. And I thought the church was going to levitate. And so anyway, I talked to Lee Carlson, the director. I says, can I get a copy of that? And he sent me almost music, you know, that they had used. I couldn't hardly read it, but I put it all together in an arrangement here. Mm-hmm. And we've performed at one church in Des Moines, but I love that composition.
I'm talking with Roger Maxwell. He's a musician and a civil rights advocate. He was recently inducted into the University of Northern Iowa School of Music Jazz Hall of Fame. He also spent many years working as the Equal Employment Compliance Officer with the Iowa State Board of Regents. Today we're talking about his life and his work, and we'll listen to a little bit of that song, Precious Lord, performed by the Wartburg Choir. This was recorded in 2009. Precious Lord, performed by the Wartburg Choir in 2009. I'll continue my conversation with Roger Maxwell in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Roger Maxwell. He is a musician, one of the founding members of the jazz program at the University of Northern Iowa. He spent many years as a music teacher, a composer, an arranger, and he also spent many, many years fighting for civil rights. He became a member of the staff for the Iowa Civil Rights Commission in 1966, and later on he served as Equal Employment Compliance Officer with the Iowa State Board of Regents for 26 years. And Roger, before we talk about your work in civil rights, I want to talk a little bit more about teaching band and teaching music in schools, because you ended up writing books that have traveled all over the place. It sold more than 700,000 copies. 14 Weeks to a Better Band is one of them. So you spread your method for teaching far and wide. What makes your method special? What is your approach?
Well, in my teaching, I found bands could not really read music where I was teaching. And so you almost had to spoon feed them note by note, so to speak. So I conducted a major study in 1972 and 1973 using 18 Iowa high school bands. And I did not ask how large the band was, but I just said, you know, I'd like to have you participate. And there were bands throughout Iowa. And the result of that study is still unbelievable to me today, because as we exchanged music during the study, we had 7 out of 9 bands play the composition which we were using, one of the compositions. 7 out of 9 high school bands played it perfectly on their third reading. That's impossible. You cannot do that with high school bands. And then two other schools, I think they made three or four mistakes, but 7 out of 9. And one of the schools, which is no longer not in session, but the state closed the school, and they played as well as Cedar Rapids Jefferson, which was the best high school band at the time. The school's Hedrick, Iowa, down in Hedrick. Mm-hmm. And those kids played just as well. So that set me on to say, what is this about remembering? And so I've been working with some neurologists and Montreal, one in former student at the University of Iowa School College of Neurology, and also a gentleman in Washington University, as to try to understand what happens in the mind regarding people who are involved in music. And what's even excited me even more, that I followed the Des Moines Sunday Register, the April issue, last Sunday in April, and they published the outstanding academic all-state students in Iowa. And in the first 12 years of the study, 62% of our best students in who were qualified as academic all-staters were involved in music. And that still excites me to think the role music plays in the academic world.
So you feel that learning music also trains the brain somehow to be a more efficient learner?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things we've been working with, not working with, but talking with people whose families have a dad or husband with Alzheimer's, and we're finding out that music is the last thing to go in the mind as Alzheimer's patients. Some incredible stories which people are relating to me. One of my former students, he stopped by. He had just attended his father's funeral in Brooklyn, Iowa, and his mother had Alzheimer's, and she did not recognize him. She did not recognize his wife. She did not recognize her daughter, grandchildren. She did not recognize her husband, who was in the casket, and she just couldn't. She hardly talked, and so when they started singing a final hymn in the garden, she sang all three verses without a mistake.
Wow. You know, Roger, I listen to you talk about teaching and music with so much passion, and it makes me wonder how you could. I mean, you'd never left music entirely behind, but you did leave teaching as a career to join the Iowa Civil Rights Commission. Why did you do that? What made it worth it to you, given how much you love to teach?
Well, I was teaching in Brooklyn, Iowa, and someone in state government had a program that with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission. It's called the Domestic Student Exchange Program. And we were to identify the group or the counselors to identify students, disadvantaged students, the Caucasians and blacks and Hispanic students. And we placed them in foster homes for a semester here. And so we placed them in these homes. Schools treated them just like other students, and the results, where they're failing in their own schools, many of them made the honor roll in their new exchange school, and I think three went on to college. But that would have never happened in their home schools. So anyway, I was there with that program. I had the Des Moines area, and then left there with the Civil Rights, Civil Rights Commission to go with the Board of Regents. And here's the interesting story, that when I was employed by Wayne Ritchie, the executive director. He said, the recommendations that we received from your four superintendents that you served under, they were very poor recommendations. They all said that you were not a very effective teacher. Well, anyway, I felt like saying, talk to my students. Well, right. That would be years later. But anyway, he said, we're going to employ you in this capacity. And so that's when I joined the commission. I mean the Board of Regents. And we found out at that time our university needed to do a lot more as far as the employment, recruitment and employment promotion of women and also persons of color.
So you were there for 26 years. During that time, what do you feel like you accomplished? What were you able to do?
One of the things that in the construction area, there were very few minorities, particularly in the construction, working on projects. And I worked with unions and contractors and minority communities in order to enhance the employment possibilities for particularly at that time minorities. And I've had a chance a couple of years ago to tell Governor Ray what a good job he did in supporting me and also Governor Branstad. And so that's how that came about here in construction. Then companies which did not have a good employment record throughout the country, I asked for their affirmative action program. Some said, we're not going to send it to you. And one of the most well-known companies in the United States, he said, I said, well, you send it to me or I'm going to cancel your contracts to universities. And so I had a call the next day
He said, "Mr. Maxwell, can I meet with you in Des Moines?" And he flew in, and we resolved that issue. Then I had another large company housed in New York, so large they were buying and selling 150 companies daily. And so they flew in five attorneys, and we met in our offices here in Des Moines to, you know, resolve that in order that they would do more employing women and minorities. And another large company out of Minneapolis, you know, oh, household word. They flew three attorneys into Cedar Rapids to do the same thing. I said, you know, you will employ more women and minorities, not only employ them, but promote them. And so in that way, these large companies have taken affirmative action at that point. So I enjoyed that experience. We never at one time in 26 years had to cancel any contracts with any companies throughout the country and in Iowa. And even here, so we had some Iowa firms that I had to take action again. One very, very well-known grocery chain, and they said, no, we don't have to answer to you. I said, well, I'll take such action against you. That firm today, I walk into the store, the grocery store, I cannot believe today what I see. Blacks, cashier, Asian cashier, Hispanics, women. It's just unbelievable because I was there where there was nobody as far as color employed that is in these capacities.
We've come so far in Iowa in so many ways, but it was about 20 years ago that you and your wife moved to Windsor Heights, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And when you moved to Windsor Heights, even then, 20 years ago is not very long ago.
Oh, no.
You ran into people in your neighborhood who wouldn't speak to you.
Oh, yeah. 2 years, the gentleman would not speak to me. And it goes back. I understood because from 5 years old, I knew what to expect. So it did not, you know, throw me in any way, shape, or form. I knew what to expect. That's going to happen. Even when we moved to Des Moines to go to an apartment, large apartment complex, same problem, you know, had to wait and wait and wait. And we were living in a trailer home 8 feet wide and 48 feet long, had a 3-year-old child. You know, where are we going to live when we move to Des Moines? And the same issues here at the apartment complex. And they waited and waited until the last moment, and they find, well, you can move in, which we did. And we were there for 4 years.
Oh, then with all of that, how did you keep yourself from becoming bitter? I mean, you had to deal with this from early childhood on, and a lot of progress was made, but in some ways, you found yourself right back where you started over and over again. How did you keep from becoming bitter about that?
Well, I just knew what to expect. So I've always been a planner, you know. While there, you know, whoever's discriminated against my family, I have plans to do other things. You know, I don't have time, didn't have time to dwell on that those matters here. And when we moved to the east side of Des Moines, that was very interesting. We moved there, and the transaction had taken place, but the realtor had given the key to our neighbor, and the neighbor wouldn't come forth with the key. So here we are, ready to move in, and couldn't find the key to the house. So finally, somebody persuaded the neighbor to give us the keys that would go in the house, and then across the street there was a police officer, and his daughter was so sweet. She had to be about 18, and she came to welcome us, and he told her, "Don't you ever go across the street again to talk to those people." that's the expectation. We knew what was coming, so you just adapt.
Now you are 83 years old, and this honor of being inducted into UNI's School of Music Jazz Hall of Fame is a wonderful and much deserved honor. When you reflect on your career, both in music and in civil rights today, what are you most proud of?
Oh, I, it's not a matter of looking back in time. You know, new projects, something new to do. I wrote the director over the School of Music, John Valentine, recently, and told him the honor has. I have not accepted it yet. I don't understand what the honor is. I have had so much fun doing it, but I don't understand. And I received a email just this morning from one of his office coordinators, and she said some of the nicest things, you know. And what I've done to everybody who responded to the article, I write their name out in Jazz with a lot of colors in it, and I say, here's your name in Jazz. And so we all have rhythm to our names. So I just heard from her today, and she thanked me. And yeah.
So when you think about new projects, what do you have on the horizon? What do you want to do?
Well, I'd like to take the arrangement of How Great Thou Art and find a large church here in Des Moines, which would have a band. It has to be a very good band, a concert band, and then a choir of about 100 voices and perform How Great Thou Art. So that's one of my major projects. And before I leave this earth, I'd like to have my Mass performed or recorded. I just can't tell you. It was divinely inspired. I wrote it in 2 weeks. You cannot write a Mass in 2 weeks. And the sounds with that piano player with Wings Over Jordan, his sounds he taught me are in that Mass. And we're at St. Mary's Church in Marshalltown. There's two special youth choirs who would take the role of the congregation and sing at a Mass. And we were performing it. And I looked at the third row, and here were three nuns who were there weeping because I know they had never heard a Mass sung that kind of music before in the church. So anyway, I'd like to do that, to have the Mass recorded. And what I wanted to do originally was at Newtown, the shooting of the students at Newtown, a school faculty. I wanted to perform it there at the church, St. Rosa de Lima Church there in Newtown. And I was talked to the choir director. And it was funny one time, I was home, and my publisher called me and said, Roger, I just received a call from Newtown, Connecticut, and there is the president of the choir at that church wants to talk to you. And then at the same time, here's the choir director. So we got on a three-way conference call. But the church secretary, I was so moved. We said, Mr. Maxwell, she says, pray for us. She says, we're hurting. And she said, at our church, we've had funerals for 4 days and two funerals a day. And that moved me so strongly to think. But anyway, just for my own satisfaction, I'd like to have that Mass recorded.
Well, I hope someone's listening who can make that happen, Roger, because that would be amazing.
Thank you.
Roger, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
You really are an inspiration. Such an honor.
Thank you, Charity.
I've been talking with Roger Maxwell, musician, civil rights advocate in Iowa. We'll go out with a little bit of Earl Father Hines playing the piano. Earl Hines once stayed in the Maxwell home in Marshalltown. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.